When you look at a theater stage, from the audience, everything seems perfectly orchestrated, right? The lighting is focused, the scenery looks solid.
Yeah, it's a highly controlled picture. It's, designed to make you believe a very specific story.
Exactly. But if you were to walk backstage, like behind that heavy velvet curtain, you'd see the frantic costume changes, props held together with duct tape.
It is absolute chaos back there.
Right. And that backstage chaos is exactly what we're exposing for you today. We're pulling from defense analyses by the War Zone, geopolitical updates from the Institute for the Study of War, and reporting from the Jamestown Foundation and Newsweek.
And all of this is from late June of 2026.
Yeah, so our mission today is really to connect the dots. We're going to map out the ripple effects, starting from Russia's internal elite politics, and look at the bizarre military developments those politics are forcing.
Because you really can't look at a military development in Russia in a vacuum anymore. Every domestic pressure point in Moscow is sending out shockwaves.
Shockwaves that, dictate naval exercises in the Pacific or ceasefire negotiations in the Middle East. So let's start mapping those out at the source, which is the Kremlin.
Right, the very center of it all.
If you just look at the public stage, you have Vladimir Putin claiming he is ready for peace talks. He gave a major speech in June leaning into this.
Yeah, and his foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, has been constantly echoing that sentiment too.
But the Institute for the Study of War, ISW, they basically poured cold water on that narrative by looking at the actual starting demands.
Oh, absolutely. Because those demands are based heavily on the 2022 Istanbul Protocols, which, I mean, fundamentally changes the definition of the word peace here.
How so? Like, what were those protocols actually asking for?
Well, those Istanbul Protocols were negotiated back in the early days of the conflict, right? When Russian armored columns were still advancing on Kyiv.
Right.
So they essentially demand complete Ukrainian capitulation. If implemented today, they would permanently cap the size of Ukraine's military. Yeah, and ban them from ever joining NATO and prohibit them from receiving Western military assistance. And crucially, they impose zero reciprocal restrictions on Russian forces.
So, wait, if Putin is claiming he's ready to talk, but his starting demand is basically that Ukraine dismantles its defenses and just, hands over the keys, isn't that purely political theater?
Oh, 100%.
It's like offering to negotiate the price of a house, but demanding the seller just gives you the deed before you even sit down at the table.
That's a great way to put it. And Putin's own terminology really gives away the strategy here. He frequently uses the phrase battlefield realities when discussing these potential negotiations.
Right, I've heard that phrase a lot.
Yeah, it's a deliberate cognitive warfare tactic. He's trying to project this image to both the Ukrainian populace and their Western backers that the Russian military is an unstoppable juggernaut.
Like they're entirely unbothered by the grinding conflict.
Exactly. And that they're on the verge of collapsing Ukrainian defenses. The underlying message is basically further resistance is futile, so the West should force Ukraine to fold right now.
But the Jamestown Foundation reporting paints a very different reality behind the curtain. There is a growing, highly significant rift among Russian elites.
Yeah, the sociological data on this is really fascinating.
Right. Sociologist Igor Eidman's analysis suggests that certain factions of the elite are actually pressuring Putin to find an off-ramp.
Because they view this as a deadlocked, economically ruinous war.
Exactly. And this is reportedly the mechanism behind why oligarchs like Roman Abramovich were ever permitted to engage in back-channel talks with President Zelensky in the first place.
Well, Putin finds himself trapped between two fiercely opposing camps right now. On one side, you have the pragmatists feeling the economic
The bounce on
squeeze.
the other side?
You have the hardline hawks, championed by figures like Sergei Karaganov. These hawks are demanding the complete militarization of the Russian state and economy.
Basically going all in.
All in, along with an aggressive reliance on nuclear deterrence. For these hardliners and the vast network of state propagandists who fueled this war fever, this isn't just about territorial gains anymore.
It's about their own survival.
Exactly. Personal, physical survival. If the war ends in anything less than an unambiguous, parade-worthy victory, they're terrified of peacetime accountability.
Right, because they've built this besieged fortress mentality, and if the siege lifts, they lose their power and, well, potentially their freedom.
Former spy Andrei Bedrukhov articulated this perfectly at a recent economic forum. He basically predicted that Russia will remain on a war footing for the next couple of decades.
That ace! Wow.
Yeah, he's talking about conditioning two entire generations to be defined solely by conflict. And from a psychological standpoint, Putin's becoming increasingly insulated within this echo chamber.
He's actively filtering out contradictory intelligence, right?
Yes, and leaning heavily on these hawks who continuously assure him that total victory is a historical inevitability.
Which introduces a massive risk for the region. I mean, if Putin's inner circle is demanding a breakthrough to justify their survival, they might push him to escalate dramatically rather than compromise.
That's the real danger here. The ISW reporting flags a couple of terrifying paths for that.
Like dragging Belarus deeper into the conflict?
Right, or even eyeing aggression against the Baltic states. Integrating Belarus is a highly probable mechanism for escalation.
Because of that Union State Treaty.
Exactly. It isn't just an alliance on paper. It's a series of legal frameworks from the late 90s designed to heavily integrate Russia and Belarus politically and militarily.
So leveraging that framework means Putin could legally, under their own shared doctrine, subsume Belarusian bases and manpower into a direct offensive.
Effectively opening a massive new front without having to declare war on a new country.
That's incredibly concerning. And this pressure from the hawks to produce a victory leads us directly to the actual situation on the dirt. Because what Putin's inner circle is demanding and what the military can actually supply are colliding spectacularly.
They really are. The Kremlin projects unstoppable strength, but the tactical logistics are, frankly, a nightmare.
We see this disconnect clearly in the ISW updates regarding the front lines. Moscow regularly claims they're on the verge of major operational breakthroughs in locations like Kostyantynivka.
Right. And for context, Kostyantynivka is a critical logistical spine for Ukraine's defense in the Donetsk region.
So taking it would be a massive blow to Ukrainian supply lines.
It would. However, the reality on the ground consists mostly of small, incremental infantry infiltrations. They fail to consolidate any meaningful territorial control.
And it's worse than just a stagnant front line. Russia's own supply lines are buckling under Ukraine's intermediate range strike campaign.
Oh, the fuel shortages.
Yes. We are looking at a scenario where Russian Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak had to publicly admit to a challenging domestic fuel market. They actually instituted a total ban on gasoline exports just to manage their own demand.
I mean, this cannot be overstated. Russia is a petrostate. Their entire economic engine and geopolitical leverage are built on hydrocarbon exports. For the deputy prime minister to halt gasoline exports means the domestic shortages are critical.
And Ukraine's strategy of systematically targeting oil refineries and depots deep inside Russian territory is degrading the lifeblood of the Russian mechanized army.
Absolutely.
But the reporting shows these shortages are being felt as far east as Kamchatka Krai, which is crazy because Kamchatka is practically next to Alaska. How do strikes in Western Russia cause fuel pumps to run dry thousands of miles away on the Pacific coast?
It's all about where the infrastructure is. Russia's refinery infrastructure is heavily concentrated in its western and southern regions, closer to its historical European markets.
Okay, that makes sense.
So when you systematically knock out a fraction of that highly concentrated refining capacity, the entire transcontinental supply chain panics.
They have to reroute everything.
Exactly. They have to reroute refined fuel across the massive expanse of the country via rail, which creates monumental logistical bottlenecks, leaving the Far Eastern territories totally starved of basic resources.
It's a massive domino effect. And the scrambling doesn't stop at oil refineries. The war zone has incredible reporting on how the Russian military is radically changing its physical infrastructure to protect its most prized aviation assets.
The bombers.
Yes, from cheap, long-range Ukrainian drones. We're talking about the 295MS and the 2160 strategic bombers.
These are the heavy lifters of the Russian aerospace forces. They're capable of launching cruise missiles from deep within Russian territory.
Right. And at Engels Air Base, known as Engels 2, which is hundreds of miles from the Ukrainian border, satellite imagery confirms they're currently constructing at least 17 massive concrete and steel protective shelters for these things.
The evolution of how they protect these planes is just wild.
Oh, it really is. Historically, these multi-million dollar bombers just sat exposed on the tarmac.
Right. And when the drone strikes first started, Russia tried putting vehicle tires on the wings to confuse the optical targeting sensors of incoming drones.
Car tires. And then they tried painting 2D silhouettes of bombers on the concrete to act as decoys.
Yeah.
Now they are pouring thousands of tons of concrete. It's less like putting up a shield and more like trying to build a permanent garage around your vintage car while it's actively hailing.
The hailstorm is the perfect analogy, honestly, because it highlights a fundamental failure in doctrine.
How so?
Well, decades of Russian military planning simply never anticipated a reality where a cheaper, technologically inferior adversary could routinely launch swarms of long-range drones.
Swarms that penetrate hundreds of miles deep into sovereign airspace.
Exactly.
But wait, why go through the immense logistical nightmare of building 17 bomber-sized concrete bunkers at an active airbase? Why not just fly the planes further east, out of the range of the drone?
Because relocating them drastically reduces their operational effectiveness.
In what way?
If you move a 295 another 1,000 miles east, it has to burn thousands of pounds of fuel just to get to its launch coordinates, which means it carries significantly less payload.
Oh, I see.
Furthermore, the 295s have been out of production for decades, and the 2160 production is incredibly slow. These ancient airframes are virtually irreplaceable.
So flying them constantly just to avoid drones puts massive stress on their maintenance cycles.
Precisely. They are forced to build these bunkers because their operational rulebook has been entirely rewritten by drone warfare.
Wow. So they are desperately pouring concrete to protect legacy aircraft from cheap drones. But simultaneously, the war zone highlights how Russia is pushing the boundaries of extreme, borderline dystopian technology to bypass Western defenses.
You're talking about the Skyfall.
Yes. They are pouring billions into the SSC X9 Skyfall, or the Burevestnik in Russian.
MIT researchers recently analyzed the mechanics of the Skyfall, and it represents a terrifying leap in weapons development. It is a nuclear-powered cruise missile.
But unlike a nuclear submarine, which operates on a closed-loop system, the MIT analysis concludes the Skyfall likely uses a direct-cycle air-breathing nuclear propulsion system.
Right.
Okay, let me make sure I understand the mechanics of that. Unlike a contained reactor, this direct cycle engine breathes in atmospheric air, runs it straight through the unshielded nuclear core to rapidly heat and expand the air, and then blast it out the back as thrust.
That is the leading scientific consensus on how it operates, yes.
Wait, so the exhaust is literally radioactive?
Yes.
This thing is a flying Chernobyl. It leaves a trail of radioactive isotopes like argon, krypton, and carbon just raining down in its wake wherever it flies.
That's exactly what it does. William Alberg, who is a former director at the International Institute for Strategic Studies, essentially paints this as a terrifying vanity project.
Well, yeah. If it's subsonic, hovering around Mach 0.75, not stealthy, and leaves a radioactive trail that literally any environmental sensor can track, why spend billions on it?
It's a great question.
It sounds completely irrational for a military struggling to afford basic fuel for its troops.
Your confusion is entirely justified, and it's the exact debate happening among defense analysts right now.
Has anyone else ever tried to build something like this?
Actually, yes. The United States abandoned a nearly identical concept in the 1960s known as Project Pluto.
Really? Why'd they abandon it?
Because the environmental hazards to your own populace were catastrophic and the tactical value was minimal.
I can imagine.
The sources also note that a fatal explosion in the White Sea back in 2019 was very likely a failed attempt to recover a sunken prototype of the Skyfall from the ocean floor.
So what is the strategic rationale from the Kremlin's perspective? Why keep pushing this?
It basically boils down to two things, range and psychology.
Okay.
Because it's nuclear powered, it does not rely on a finite tank of jet fuel. In theory, the Kremlin could launch this from the Arctic, have it loiter over the ocean for days, fly completely around the globe, and approach a target in the U.S. from an entirely unexpected vector.
Like coming up through the Gulf of Mexico.
Exactly. Completely bypassing traditional northern early warning radars.
That makes sense tactically, but still.
Right. But Albert's assessment that it's a symbol system is highly accurate. It proves that Putin maintains this deep obsession with super weapons.
Weapons that project an image of unstoppable Russian scientific prowess to his domestic audience.
Largely, regardless of their practical utility on a modern battlefield.
Wow. And because Russia and China are forcing the U.S. to look toward Eastern Europe and the Pacific simultaneously, it creates massive strategic friction.
Yeah, Russia isn't flexing these muscles in a vacuum.
Exactly. The prolonged conflict and this pursuit of new power dynamics are deeply intertwined with their allies holding the other end of the rope.
Newsweek's reporting highlights how critical the relationship between Moscow and Beijing has become.
Right. Recently, the Chinese PLA Navy's Task Force 83, which includes the training ship Qijiguang and the amphibious transport Kunlunshan, arrived in Vladivostok.
For joint training with Russia's Pacific Fleet.
On the public stage, China presents itself as this neutral party calling for peace in Ukraine.
But the backstage reality heavily documented by U.S. and European intelligence agencies, is that China acts as a decisive enabler of Russia's war economy.
How so?
They are absorbing heavily discounted Russian oil and gas, and in return, providing vital dual-use exports. Things like microchips, machine tools, optical sensors.
The stuff that keeps the Russian military-industrial base from collapsing.
Precisely. And the security ties are moving past just trade.
Yeah, while the overall number of joint military drills might have dipped slightly in recent months, they just conducted their first joint submarine exercise.
That's a huge deal.
The U.S. Coast Guard is actively noting upticks in joint patrols near Alaska, and Japanese Defense Minister Shinjiro Koizumi publicly called a recent joint bomber patrol a deliberate show of force against Japan.
Yeah, it's very intentional.
For anyone trying to make sense of global security right now, this is the partnership to watch. It feels like two massive tectonic plates aligning to challenge the U.S. How deep does this trust actually go?
Well, it is crucial to define what this relationship is. And what it isn't. It is not a formal military alliance like NATO.
Okay.
There is no mutual defense treaty guaranteeing China will fight for Russia. However, their shared overarching goal of dismantling U.S. military dominance and creating a multipolar world is an incredibly powerful strategic glue.
So practically, what does that look like?
To understand the depth of trust, you have to look at that submarine exercise you mentioned.
Why is that so significant?
Submarine warfare relies entirely on acoustic stealth. When you operate submarines together, you are inherently exposing your acoustic signatures, the unique fingerprints of your most secretive vessels, to the other country.
Oh, wow. I hadn't thought of that.
You do not share that space unless you are locking in a long-term strategic alignment that goes far beyond a temporary marriage of convenience.
And because Russia and China are forcing the West to heavily invest resources and attention into Eastern Europe and the Pacific, it creates a massive geopolitical blind spot in the Middle East. And Iran is driving a truck right through that blind spot, pushing the boundaries to see exactly what they can get away with while the world looks the other way.
The Institute for the Study of War's Iran update details some incredibly aggressive maneuvering by Tehran across multiple domains.
Starting in the Strait of Hormuz, Iran is actively negotiating with Oman to establish a joint mechanism to manage the strait,
potentially charging what they call service fees for safe passage.
Yeah, looking at the ISW's analysis, this setup reads almost like a global toll booth run by the mob in international waters.
It really does.
But why should you, the average listener, care about a maritime legal dispute over service fees?
Because roughly 20% of the world's total oil supply passes through that specific geographic choke point.
20%.
If Iran successfully establishes a mechanism where they can legally regulate transit and charge fees under the guise of maritime security, they gain a stranglehold over global commerce.
So it would allow them to restrict passage at their discretion.
Effectively holding the global supply chain and the price of gas at your local pump, hostage during any international negotiation.
They are acting with intense brazenness regarding their economy as well. Iranian officials are boldly rejecting any U.S. oversight on how they spend unfrozen funds from recent international agreements.
Oh, yeah. They've explicitly stated they intend to funnel that economic relief directly into their military sectors and what they call the Axis of Resistance.
Which is the term for Iran's vast network of proxy militias across the region, right?
Right, which includes heavily armed groups like Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas in Gaza, and the Houthis in Yemen.
Mm.
By publicly declaring they will fund these proxies with unfrozen assets, Iran is daring the international community to intervene.
Knowing full well Western diplomatic bandwidth is completely exhausted.
Exactly.
Which brings us to the precarious situation in Lebanon. The U.S. Central Command, or CNTECOM, has proposed a deconfliction cell to monitor the fragile ceasefire there.
Right.
This cell would include U.S. and Iranian representatives, but crucially, it completely excludes Israeli representation.
And this creates a monumental structural imbalance in how information is processed and how narratives are formed.
How so?
Well, the United States does not maintain a ground troop presence in southern Lebanon. So CENTCOM relies heavily on the Israel Defense Forces for tactical, on-the-ground reporting of ceasefire violations.
But Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps Quds Force, their elite unconventional warfare branch, has officers physically embedded locally alongside Hezbollah.
Exactly. That's the dynamic that causes so much concern.
Right.
If a skirmish occurs, an IDF soldier has to report the incident up through their chain of command, which eventually gets relayed to CENTCOM, who then brings the report to the deconfliction cell.
That sounds like a long game of telephone.
It is. Meanwhile, the embedded Quad's force officer can instantly communicate their version of events directly to the Iranian representatives in the cell.
So Iran controls the narrative because their reporting structure is vastly shorter and embedded right at the point of friction.
You nailed it.
Israeli Ambassador Yekiel Leiter warned that this structural blind spot offers Hezbollah a new lease on life. When powers like Russia successfully tie up Western resources and attention, nations like Iran feel immensely emboldened.
They really do. They extract economic relief, embed their influence deeper into conflict zones like Lebanon, and assert control over vital global choke points.
The tactical shifts we see, whether it's pouring concrete over bombers in Russia, sharing acoustic data in the Pacific, or manipulating diplomatic cells in the Levant, are all symptoms of a rapidly shifting global order,
where the traditional deterrents are being openly tested every single day.
To summarize today's journey, we started behind the curtain in the increasingly hawkish halls of the Kremlin, looking at how the political theater of peace talks masks a reality of elite divisions and massive logistical failures.
Right.
We explored how those fuel shortages and drone strikes forced Russia to build sprawling hailstorm garages for irreplaceable bombers while simultaneously pouring resources into radioactive vanity projects like the Skyfall missile.
Which is still just baffling.
We followed that ripple effect to Vladivostok, where China is acting as a decisive enabler for Russia's economy, deepening naval trust in a bid for a multipolar world.
Uh-huh.
And finally, to the Middle East, where Iran is capitalizing on a distracted West to assert control over the Strait of Hormuz and exploit structural imbalances in Lebanon.
Every single piece is connected, and the speed at which these tectonic plates are shifting requires constant vigilance.
Which brings us to a final thought for you to chew on. Building on that Lebanon deconfliction cell, think about the fundamental architecture of that cell.
It's fascinating.
If the international mechanisms we build to stop conflict are structurally biased to give one side a massive narrative and intelligence advantage on the ground, are we actually preventing war, or are we just quietly dictating who is positioned to win the next one?
That's the real question.
Something to keep in mind as these global chess pieces keep moving. Thank you so much for joining us for this deep dive into the geopolitical backstage. Keep questioning the surface narrative, keep looking for the mechanisms behind the headlines, and we'll see you next time.